folks. Welcome to another episode of Bikes, Burgers, Beers. I'm Big Steph, and today we have a casual and candid chat with Brian, who is one of those hidden gems in Australia. A real Royal Enfield fan who kind of discovered the brand later on in life. We chatted to him about tinkering and about losing interest in projects and a lot more. You know, Brian's a wealth of knowledge and quite a frank person who tells it how it is. There's no sugarcoating here, you get what you get, and that's as genuine as they come. Brian has also done a lot of adventures around Australia and more, not only on his Royal Enfields, but before then. He rode around Australia in 21 days on a Kawasaki Z900 with the Ampol Around Australia Reliability Race. So stick around to hear some more of what he's been up to right here on Bikes, Burgers, Beers.
Out trying to get some parts for one of my Royal Enfield bike that I've had with this guy for nearly a year.
Oh, well,
that's
right.
All right.
Yeah.
He's a bit, under the pump, or he doesn't want to do it. I was going to take it away from him, but
right.
He's promised me he'll do it this week, so we'll see.
Oh, okay. So you're fixing the bike for someone, or they're fixing it for you?
No, I'm fixing it. I'm doing up a 1937 500 side valve, just all bits and pieces. I got it up onto, it's rolling. I got new tyres, I got the wheels on, I got the handlebars on, I got the seat on. I'm just rebuilding the motor now.
Yeah, right.
Endeavouring
okay.
to get that up to pop it in, yeah.
Oh, nice one, man. That sounds like a heap of fun. Nice little project.
Yeah, it is. I've sort of lost the plot a little bit. we all go through stages like that, I suppose. But, buddy, you know, you've got all the enthusiasm in the world and then a few little walls come up and you think, oh, I'm sort of over it for the moment.
Absolutely, man. Yeah, I know that feeling with some of the projects I've done in the past as well. And, yeah, it's sometimes you just hit a wall and you think, oh, why am I doing this? It's not fun anymore.
Yeah. Oh, well, I still enjoy it when I'm out there, but I'm more interested in riding and working around the property at the moment because of COVID and that.
Yeah.
It sort of stuffed me up as much as it stuffed up other people. I'm not real interested in going out and meeting up. So I'm happy just to do little jobs around the farm. Like I've got chooks, I've got sheep, I've got fences to fix and work on. And all those sort of light jobs.
Yeah, well, there's always fences to fix on farms, that's for sure.
I've only got 3 acres, but, you know, there's always something to do. Yeah,
absolutely, mate. Oh, nice one. So I wanted you on the show because there was a comment you made on the Royal Enfield Facebook group when someone was talking about doing long distance riding on their classic, and I saw your post about, you know, all the adventures that you've done. So I thought I'd get you on the show just to share some of your stories with my listeners. You know, because they're fun anyway. They're fun adventures no matter what bike you're on. But doing it on a Royal Enfield can sometimes be even more fun, in my opinion, because you're not flying through places at, you know, 100-plus kilometres an hour in most occasions. So, you know, that was the main reason I wanted you on the show, because it sounds like you've done a fair bit on your Royal Enfield or a few of them, if you've got a few. I thought I'd get you here to share that with our listeners. I thought it'd be a fun episode to do because, who doesn't like, you know, hearing people's stories about where they've ridden to?
Yep.
So, yeah,
yep.
thanks for taking the time to be on the show today.
No, that's all right. If I can get some things out there for people, that's really good. If I can, I'd just do a little, if you want me to, a little bit of background where I come from. And
absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Normally I start off by asking people where they first started riding and what got them interested in motorbikes.
I was actually born on a farm in South Australia. I'm a sheep farmer's child, whatever you want to call it. So I grew up in South Australia. I now live in Victoria, but I grew up there and my motorbike, I've always wanted motorbikes, but I got my first motorbike when I was 11, 250 side valve BSA, and I paid $50 for it back then. So that's where I started. And then I bought a 125 TS 125 Suzuki, and I did a bit of scrambling for a while. Well, They don't call it scrambling anymore. The older listeners all know what I'm talking about, but they call it motocross or whatever now. And then I, you know, just from then, my first experience riding on the road, as I actually ended up registering, like I bought that Suzuki before I even had my license. And then when I put it on the road, after scrambling it for a while, I put the lights and all that back on. And the first night I was out with a mate and we got booked for speeding. So that was the start of my road riding. So my mum wasn't very happy. I never had a dad, but I mean, my mum wasn't very happy. But yeah, when I told her or she found out. So that was the start of riding on the road.
Hopefully that didn't set a precedence for future endeavours on the road.
sadly, it did up and probably up until about 10, 12 years ago. Yes, I used to regularly get booked and lose my licence. Yeah, I was often in trouble going to court. You used to go to court in those days. Mm-hmm. But anyway, yeah, it's a lot simpler now. You just pay a parking fine, don't you? I did cause a bit of trouble for myself. But, and then I went on to a 350 Honda 4, and that's really when I started going touring and making miles on that. And from the Japanese bikes, I sort of miss a few things out, otherwise it'll get a bit too long. But I ended up on BMWs. I met people in Western Australia when I was working over there as a 19-year-old. As soon as I finished my carpentry apprentice, I just nicked off and ended up joining a circus in Norseman. And I only stayed with them for 2 days. That was a crazy job, that was. That was just crazy. You never got paid. They just fed you. I didn't enjoy that at all.
No.
So if you ever think of going to the circus, think about it again. they just work you to the ground and all they do is give you feed.
Yeah.
So then I ended up in Albany and I met a motorcyclist who was into BMWs and I was on a Z900 at that stage. And backtracking a little bit, that same year I rode around Australia on that Z900 in an Ampol round Australia reliability race sort of thing.
Right.
It was 21 days around Australia. It was 1978, I think it was.
Wow.
They only ran it twice. Anyway, I went on that as the youngest bloke. There was guys in their 50s and 60s on it and amazing. Whatever. But, yeah, I went on the 900. And then I ended up in WA working over there and I met these BMW riders and I thought, this is the group, this is the people for me.
Yeah, nice. How old were you when you did that lap around Australia with the Ampol reliability?
19.
19.
Yeah. I just finished my apprenticeship. And that came up and I did that. Then I think I went back and worked for a couple of weeks with the boss through my apprenticeship just to finish off. And then that was it. I was gone. I just disappeared. So just rode lots around Australia and through Australia on the BM. Took that out back a lot. BMs were the common thing, like old boxes back then. Mm. The common thing for dirt roads and, you know, tail shafts and really simple motor. So I met heaps of people, mostly Western Australians, and because they were real desert riders, which I loved out in the desert. I live near the mountains now. I'm not much of a mountain man, but I love the deserts. So I did that for quite some time, and then I got into sidecars. I built my first sidecar when I was in my early 20s.
Okay.
Road sidecars with BMWs on it, like on the road.
Yep.
And everything I did was about touring and making miles, you know, like I'd do rides across Australia. Like I'd just leave where I lived in Adelaide. I'd leave there and I'd go to the border run in Western Australia, which is like 1,200 kilometres. You just do that in a day.
Yeah.
And have a drink and then come home again. So that's where my speeding problems were. that's the sort of thing I did there. And so I did that for quite a while. And then I don't know if I'm jumping too fast.
That's all right.
I went through lots of bikes, and then I ended up separating from my wife back in Adelaide, and I had a business and stuff like that. Had a bit of a breakdown, and I hopped on me. I bought a DR650 to go touring on, and then I thought, oh, I'd like to go to Africa, so I shipped it over to Africa.
Oh wow!
And I was going to have a mate. He was going to meet up with me, but I got to Africa with my bike, and he never ever turned up, and I've never ever seen him since.
It's really no weird. Way.
Yeah, weird. Weird as weird. He just never came. So I took off and I did two stints in Africa. I left the bike there. I did 5 months just zigzagging up through Africa. And then I went, then I left for a few months and I went back for 3 more months. And I ended up getting up to Addis Ababa in Ethiopia. And I lost the plot again after that because I can't really stand authority. I'm not real good at authority, and I'm not really good at border crossings and people. Crowds don't do anything for me.
Yep.
So I got a bit anxious there, and I thought, no, I'm over this. I just, all the corruption and that, I just couldn't handle it.
Yeah.
So I just put the bike on a plane and myself on a plane and flew back home. I said, that's it. 8 months and 4,000 kilometres, I was over it.
Wow.
Yeah, I had a ball. I met lots of people on that trip. And not long before that, probably a year or so before that, I shipped another bike, a BMW. I had an RS. I shipped that over to Canada. And I did Canada, Alaska, and Northwest America for 3 months.
Oh, wow.
Riding around there. So that was a great trip too.
I was going to say that would have been a different experience compared to riding through the African continent.
Oh, positively. Just completely, like, you know, chalk and cheese, you know. Mm. Like, yeah, just so different. Then I did a tour. I've sort of misplaced the years, but I did a tour with a guide and all that in a group. Mm-hmm. I went to India and rode a Royal Enfield, bits of India, you know, Rajasthan and, you know, New Delhi and, yeah, little bits of India. We did, I don't know what it was, maybe it might have been a 9-day or a 12-day trip. I can't quite remember now.
Yeah.
So I did that. I did two of those over there in India, and then wow. I did one in Vietnam and rode up through Vietnam on a tour. Yeah. So
amazing.
That's sort of a bit of a background of what I've been doing and that.
Yeah. If you were given the opportunity to revisit any one of those adventures again, which one would you pick? Which one would you say was your most memorable?
Oh, Africa, because of the time and the people. And, yeah. You know, like, you don't have memory. I find if everything's running smoothly, you don't really have a lot of things to remember. You
That's
know,
right.
Because it's all working perfectly.
Yeah.
But so many things didn't go wrong, but there's so many things happened in Africa, you know, like I rode my bike for so long to just wear the tires out, and when it blew, that's mm-hmm. when I changed the tire. It didn't matter where it was.
Yeah.
Wherever it blew, I had spare tires. At one stage there, I had four tires, two rears and one front. Three rears and one front on yep. the back of the bike, ready, you know, to change, and spare tubes and that. Mm-hmm. So I just wore the tires out, because in Africa, when I was doing it, it wasn't easy to find tires.
Yeah,
it was just a bit difficult. So Africa would have to be, you know, like, I got pulled over by police who wanted to see my insurance. That's the best one they get you on.
Yeah,
there's, you know, need insurance papers. And I wasn't in the best of moods that day, and I went off my brain at them that, you know, Australia donates all this money and I'm over here just riding around and there's no such thing as insurance. Like, they're just telling you rubbish.
Yeah.
Trying to get graft and corruption money out of you.
Yeah.
And I just stood my ground, and, you know, I'm shaking in my boots because no one knew where I was.
That's right, and, yeah.
You know, I'm just, you know, we take you to the police station. We process you and all this sort of stuff. And I'm like, you've got to be joking, you know. Like, I know I just went off my tree. I just lost the plot. And they said, you go, you crazy. And so I just got on my bike and rode away. I have no idea where I was going or what I was doing, but I was getting out of there.
I was going to ask, how did you get out of it? But it was obviously you just went off your nut and they thought, this guy's too crazy, just let him go. It's not worth the...
Oh, exactly. No, they said to me, you know, dead true. They said, I remember that. They said, oh, you crazy. You go, you get out of here. And I just got on me. But like, there was bloody, sorry, swearing, but they were...
Oh, no, you can swear all you like.
There was four of them there and just me. And like I say, no one knew where I was.
Yeah.
It wasn't like I book in every minute. And back then, you know, this is, I don't know, 15 years ago, you know, spot trackers and all that, I don't even use them now. So, no one knew where I was. So I did the best I could, but, I got a bit cranky.
Understandably, you got a bit cranky. I mean, you know, things like that can always just disrupt what you're up to. And it's not like you're up to no good. You're just traveling through a country, enjoying yourself. And, you know, sometimes you end up in places like this where authority can harass you for whatever reason. And it's, you know, it's often places like that, I guess, that this does happen or is more common because, you know, people are a bit more destitute. So they're more than happy to take advantage of foreigners and take bribes and things like that just to make a few extra bucks.
Yeah. No, it is sad because they don't. Yeah, they don't earn a lot, and you know, they see you and they, you know, white. You're wealthy. You know,
yeah.
that's it. That's all there is to it. And I'm not being prejudiced. I'm not
at all.
It's just a fact that you know these countries you travel to. You know, I've had the same thing, even traveling in Australia. You know, and you know, you're white. Well, you got money. Give it to me. So it just winds me up a little bit. But generally speaking, it was a great trip. And like I say, I learned a lot about myself too.
Yeah.
And you become resilient or whatever that word is. And I don't generally go camping. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, I go camping, but I don't sit around a fire and cook the food or carry food with me. Mm-hmm. I like to eat with the locals. Even in Australia, I don't go and hide in the bush to cook a meal. I just find that, to me, a bit negative. Like, you're not really being part of the community or the country that you're in.
That's right.
You might as well park in a bloody motel and watch the television because you're not. I go to the shops, like I couldn't speak the language in most of these countries, and I'd just go to a food, you know, where everybody was going to get something to eat, and I'd just walk around at the tables and have a look, you know, unless they had pictures on the wall, which they sometimes had, but I'd go and look at people's food and, you know, I was a bit rude, I suppose, but I'd look and, oh, that looks all right to me, so I'd just point to the hostess and say, you know, I want one of them, man.
Exactly.
Serve that up, whatever that is called.
Yeah, and I think you're right in saying, you know, if you're not going to do that, then you might as well just sit in the hotel in your four walls. Because for me, and I know a lot of people that travel and do long distance traveling like that, you want to immerse yourself in the community that you end up in, whether it's for one night or a week or a month, who knows how long. But otherwise, what's the point? You know, you're not going to find out about what the local people do, what they eat, what they do for fun, what they do for work or anything. And sometimes you end up, you know, if you're lucky or unlucky, depending on your circumstances, you might meet a friend.
Yeah.
You might make friends there and go back. You know, I remember reading Jupiter's Travels with Ted Simon, and when he did his second book, he went back to the same place and he met up with or he saw this... a camel hire sort of guy in Egypt, and they remembered each other, and he was there 20 years later still hiring out camels for tourists, and he couldn't believe he saw Ted Simon's face again, and they were like best mates, you know, and they hung out together. And to me, that was one of the most memorable parts of that book. And I think that can happen to any of us when we travel somewhere, if we choose to. If you're going to go hide out in your campsite or a hotel or motel room, then you're likely never going to experience that. So that's really cool hearing that someone like you out there that's actually still doing that. That's great.
Oh, well, I couldn't name them on my hands and toes how many times I've met someone and they've taken me home. And that's, to me, like I get, not a lot of it, but I get people saying, oh, you know, aren't you scared out there by yourself? Because I travel by myself. Like I leave home by myself. I've virtually never, ever left home with anybody. I might leave home with my wife or something sometimes, but normally I'm on the bike and I'm riding by myself, and it's the people I meet and the people that have taken me home and the beds that I've slept in and the breakfasts I've had or the meals I've had or whatever.
Yeah.
In Australia, in Africa, in Canada, like, you know, I was in Alaska, and I come to this pub. I love my pubs. No,
oh, that's
like
good. That's good to hear.
I loved going to pubs and looking at the walls and seeing pictures or something about the locals, you know, what happens here. Like I never, and I'm going on a bit, but I never read the paper when I'm home. Just I have no interest in reading a newspaper. But when I'm traveling, I'll often pick up the local rag or the local paper and I'll read that because I'm interested in where I am and what these people do. And I find that, for me, the most enjoyable part of the ride. Okay, I love the riding.
Of course.
But I love meeting new, I enjoy meeting new people and talking to them. You know, I don't want to take them home and I don't want to live with them, but I want to just pass through their life for 10 minutes, an hour, whatever, and they pass through my life and then I'm gone.
Absolutely.
I'll probably never ever see them again.
Yeah.
And that's fine with me.
Yeah.
I'm happy with that.
But it's a beautiful little exchange, because sometimes they can be the most memorable bits of communication with two people. And like you said, you may only meet each other once and never see each other again, but sometimes those sort of memories can stay for life.
The one I specifically remember, I was in Alaska, and I pulled into this pub. That's where I was going with that conversation. I pulled into this pub, and it was sort of like on an Indian reservation or some sort of reservation. It meant nothing to me. It was a pub. So I just walked in there and I didn't leave for 3 days, man. Like, they just took me home and bedded me. Another lot of motorcyclists come along, and I said, man, you got to get me out of here. I can't seem to get out of this pub. It was just, it was just so much fun, and they were so lovely to me. I just couldn't figure out how to leave, you know.
Yeah.
Each day I'd go back to the pub and we'd start drinking again and playing darts and pool and far out, I've got to get out of here. This is madness. But, and I wouldn't remember those people if I tripped over them, but they just, because I was by myself, that's where I was also going with this, because you're by yourself, you're not a threat to anybody.
Yeah.
And most people will come and talk to you, whatever. But if you've got two of your ugly buggers or three of your ugly buggers, they're not really going to take you home or invite you out somewhere, are they? They're a bit, not offended. I don't know what the word is. Yeah, apprehensive.
Yeah.
To come up and talk to a group. So,
yeah, that's right. Yeah. All righty, folks. We've come to that point in the show today where we're going to take a short break to hear from our show sponsors. Please stay tuned, and remember, those discount codes still apply, so make sure you use them. Time to get myself a new jacket and a matching pair of gloves. With the discount code over at Johnny Reb, our show sponsor, it makes it really affordable, and I have to say, damn, I look good in some Johnny Reb gear. All I have to do is enter the code BIKES15 at checkout over at johnnyreb.com.au. That's BIKES15. And I instantly get 15% off all my purchases. And to top it off, if I spend over $49, they give me free shipping. That's easy. johnnyreb.com.au. Oh, yeah. Riding your bike? Thirsty work. Mowing the lawn? Thirsty work. You deserve a refreshing drink. My top beer, the Nectar of the Hops from Willie the Boatman, is rated number 99 in the top beers of Australia. Well, it's number one in my household, and just to make it sweeter, Willie the Boatman are offering you 20% off all their purchases on their website. All you got to do is enter the code hashtag bikes, burgers, beers at checkout on willytheboatman.com and you get beer delivered to your door. Nothing like cracking open a cold one after wrestling with the lawnmower. Still thirsty? Nah, not anymore. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, back to the show. Out of all the trips you've done, and obviously you've ridden different bikes in on different continents and all that, what would you say was one of the best bikes you've ridden that you would go, oh, look, you know what, if I'm going to do that trip, that is the bike to do it on? What would that bike be that you've owned?
Everybody's probably heard this before, but the DR650.
Yeah.
You can't beat it, man. You can't. I have sold it now, but I did over 100,000 kilometres on that thing and never let me down, did everything I wanted. It was just fantastic. Like, yeah, people can't understand how I sold it after all those years. Like, I had it since 2003 and I only sold it last year, so, you know, nearly 20 years. And people can't figure that out. And I'm like, well, you know, I've enjoyed it. Let someone else have a go at it. But
yeah,
I'd seriously buy another one. Yes, I would. They don't make them anymore. But
yeah.
Funny story about that. I was in Africa with my DR650 and I rolled up to this younger couple, a bloke and a Sheila, and they're on old XT500s, if you remember what they were.
I do.
And they're Yamaha. They're kicking crap out of them, trying to get them started. And I said, why didn't you come here on an electric start? Oh, yeah, but the electric start could play up. And I hit the button. I said, well, it hasn't done anything wrong in 66,000 kilometres. And I just pushed the button and rode away. I thought, you're crazy, man. Like, it was stinking hot. Like, it was, you know, and all these people, that leads me to another thing. I'm a really naughty person. I don't ride in all this fancy get up and all this safety gear. When I rode Africa, if it was hot, I was in shorts and a t-shirt.
Yeah.
I always had boots on. But when I met these people from, you know, generally Europeans, and they're dressed up to the nines in the latest leather jackets and latest bloody leather pants and all the leather stuff. And I'm there, I don't know how you do that, man. Like, that'd just, like, you'll die. Like, in Australia in the heat, you'd die in that stuff. Like,
yeah.
I'm just, you've got to be mad. And they'd look at me, of course, and say, oh, you're in bloody shorts, you know. Haven't you got any protection? I said, well, yeah, no, not really. but I'm just, yeah, that's who I am and that's what I am. When I rode around, well, not rode around, when we did India, I did the same in India. Like, I wore shorts all the time. I'm not putting these bloody heavy leather pants and all this wet weather gear on and all this safety gear. You've got to be joking. When I go enduro riding, yes, I have all the safety gear and, you know, I look after myself. But when I'm road riding, nah, I just find it all crazy in myself. But, you know, I'm not saying don't do it, but I'm saying what I do.
Yeah. Well, absolutely. That's your personal choice to do that. And obviously there's going to be loads of people out there that agree and also disagree with you, and that's fair too. You know, that's their prerogative. And we're all taking a risk with whatever we do on a motorcycle, whether it's gearing up or whether it's speeding, whether it's, you know, anything. So, yeah, at the end of the day, you want to be most comfortable, especially, I guess, in places like India where you're not really doing any high speeds either, because, you know, most of the traffic there is going fairly slowly. I'm sure there's stints of certain areas where you would be doing some higher speeds, but even then it'd be far and few between, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
No, not at all.
Exactly. But that's the way I see the world. And, I'm not telling young ones to do silly stuff like that. All I'm saying is that's what I do.
Yeah.
And I mean, I wear an open face helmet most of the time, and people reckon I'm bloody crazy.
Yeah.
I don't know. That's me.
Yeah. Fair enough, man.
So DR650.
Yeah. No, nice. I mean, look, at the end of the day, it's one of the most proven, reliable motorcycles. It you know, I'm sure as far as kilometers traveled, you know, amongst all DR650 owners, it's probably one of the most longest distance running motorcycles ever, and there's a reason why they're so good and so popular, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah. you can't go wrong with a single cylinder air cooled engine. Simple.
Yeah,
positively. Yeah, Suzuki definitely did the right thing with that bike. Unfortunately, it's a shame they discontinued it, but I think it was more to do with environmental policies and emissions and things like that, which, you know.
Yeah, positively. Well, that's what's happened. The Euro 5 or something. Plenty of them there.
That's right. There's plenty of them still out there secondhand. And the alternative is the Kawasaki KLR 650 is probably just as reputable. Yeah. And Kawasaki has just released a new version of that, I think, which does adhere to the Euro 5 standard.
So hopefully
that's right. Yeah, fuel injected, dual channel ABS, all that stuff. And, probably a million different catalytic converters in it to reduce the emissions and who knows what else. But that sounds like an incredible thing to jump on a reliable bike like that, and especially, you know, like you said, hitting the start button in front of those people trying to kickstart their bike, which they probably flooded or something. And
I just thought it was humorous. They said, oh, you know, your electric start could break down. Oh, hasn't been 66,000 kilometers. Like, yeah. You know, get over it.
That's right. Yeah.
Funny.
Yeah. So you mentioned you built some sidecars before. Are you still into sidecars? Or
yes, I've got two of them. I've got a XJR 1300 with the home built. Like, I built everything.
Okay.
Home built sidecar on it, and the leading links I built for it. And subframe. You know, connecting point. I did all of that.
Okay.
I used to run BMWs on the same sidecar, K100s years ago, but I just got over the shaft drive, kept breaking down and the gearbox playing up, and the differentials always need work. I just got sick to death of every trip I wanted to go on. I had to do something to it. Whereas, I just wanted to go for a ride.
Yeah.
And with the XJR, with the Japanese bike on it, I just kick the tires and change the oil. Like, I don't have to worry about anything. It's chain driven.
Yeah.
But chains are really good nowadays, and I've never had a breakdown in it. I just ride it. Not that I use it a lot these days, but I've got that, and I've got a Royal Enfield custom chrome with a road trial style outfit on it, sidecar on it. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I've got two.
Right. And that's a classic 500 or?
They called it the classic chrome, I think. Yeah.
Okay. Yep.
It's the first of the fuel injected unit construction engine Royal Enfield.
Okay.
2009, I think. I'm thinking that's what it is.
Yeah.
But I mean, it doesn't look anything like a custom chrome at the moment, because I've turned it into a sidecar and taken everything off, because I was going to do I entered in the 24 hour in South Australia to do it on a sidecar, and I built this up specifically for that.
Right, okay.
But I stuffed up when I did a little bit of mechanicking on it, and I got overzealous with the gasket goo, and a little teeny glob got stuck in the fuel line and seized up me rocker. So I didn't get very far. Yeah,
that's no good. Bugger.
Anyway, I fixed it. It was easy to fix.
That's good.
Ever, but I brought it home to fix it. So I didn't actually get to do that race, but not to worry. I still got the sidecar. But I widened the sidecar because I kept it really skinny for the road trials, you know, to go through the bush.
Mm.
But when I got it home, I found it really hard to ride by myself, so I widened it. So you can actually ride it on the road properly now. So, you know, by yourself, it doesn't tip. Like, it's really light, very, very light bike and sidecar. And it'll tip at any, you know, little point because it was so skinny. But now I've widened it a bit wider and, works a lot better.
Nice one. Before we sort of go on to other things, I'd like to ask you, what advice would you give someone who is thinking about heading off on their first ever long distance trip, whether it's Australia or overseas?
What sort of advice would I give them? Just bloody get up and go. don't ask the only what I see a lot, like I get on the internet quite a lot and I look at these websites and I look at these Facebook pages, and honestly, I don't know if it's the people today or the, because there's Facebook and all that, but people ask too many, put it bluntly, bloody questions. They think they want to, I think they're trying to get all these perfect answers. Man, there ain't nothing perfect on this planet.
Yeah.
And just go and do it and actually experience, you know, like I had a, I had one the other day, and I mean, I'm, this is probably no help, but I had one the other day that I couldn't help but reply to. This guy wrote on the Facebook or one of these forums, he said, oh, I've heard the DR650, I think he was talking about, I've heard the DR650 suspension isn't up to up to scratch, you know. What would you do with it?
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, no, I didn't think, I actually wrote. I wrote back and I said, man, have you actually ever ridden one for any length of time? Have you actually taken it anywhere?
Yeah.
Don't do anything to it. Like all these people, and I mean, I'm going to get shot down in flames, but you find all these people, they spend $1 squillion on a bloody perfect bike and then they go, or they don't go touring. You see them up for sale all the time. They go anywhere.
Yeah.
Just get on the bike and go and experience it. Man, when we used to ride, and I know that sounds awful, but when we rode years and years ago, we just took off with a with the best toolkit we had and we made up as we went along. If you didn't have it, you'd find something or you'd make it work. They all want to be, hand-fed, but they think they want to cover everything by asking all these questions, you know. Oh, what tank should I have? What oil should I put in the forks? What spring rate should I have?
Yeah.
I don't know. What do you ride like? How do I bloody know? You know, like, goodness sake, just get out there and do it and come back with a story, a new story, not keep hashing over the same thing.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Absolutely. No, that,
sorry, that didn't probably help, Stefano.
No, I think it does. And the reason is because, like, I've grown up riding motorbikes too. And, you know, I remember when I first got my road legal bike and my license, and I jumped on it and I did my first 1,000-kilometer ride straight away. I was, you know, 18, 19 years old by myself, much like you have done. And, you know, I never thought about it. I didn't think, oh, you know, I might get different tires for touring or I might upgrade the suspension. I just jumped on the bike and did it. You're not going to be riding that bike halfway around Australia going, oh, geez, I wish I upgraded the suspension, you know, because, and this is what I say to one of my mates, it's a famous quote I say, and it sort of encompasses everything. I say, you're not Mick Doohan. In other words, we're not out there going full stick, 100 miles an hour everywhere, whether it's through the bush, whether it's on the highway. It doesn't matter if we don't have the grippiest tires or the best Ohlins suspension. The bike's going to do it fine, and you're going to be happy with it because you're going to come back with those adventures and memories and stories to tell, like you said. So I have to agree with that, and I don't think it's bad advice. I think it's great advice. Get on the bike and just go for a bloody ride.
Yeah, dead right. Like, any bike you talk about, and I don't give a rat's which bike you talk about, from Harley to bloody Chinese to whatever, whoever's making a bike, that bike will handle better than 98% of the people who can bloody ride.
Absolutely.
It's, you know, all these, it just haven't got a, you know, these people, they say, oh, that was a great trip you did. What suspension did you have?
Yeah.
And you know, how'd it go? I said, man, it had nothing to do with that. It's
That's
me
right.
that took it, the bike there. I actually did that, you know.
That's and, right.
I thought, you're bloody so full of SHIT. I think,
yeah.
It just winds me up. My wife gets a bit cross with me. Don't let it get you. Don't. I said, yeah, but, you know, it's like that program on the telly, what's his name? The doctor, I watched that quite a bit. Becker. I don't know if you've ever watched that. I love
I haven't.
I love Becker. And he just said, you know, there's just – sorry, yeah, being I don't normally swear or whatever, but you know,
nah, go
there's
for it.
Idiots in the world and they need to be told. And, and that's sort of me, you know, they need to be told that they're an idiot. But,
yeah,
you know, I do it on Facebook and I do it on forums every now and then, but I have got a bit calmer over the last few years. I think, oh, well, you're just an idiot. Just, you know, you'll never get anywhere. Like, I've seen them so often. They'll spend $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 on a motorbike.
Yeah.
Oh, and the ad says, oh, I've built this bike up, but the trip got cancelled because my mate couldn't come with me.
Yeah.
I think you're an idiot.
Yeah. Why didn't you go anyway?
Yeah, you won't go anywhere. You're not going anywhere. Yeah. So, no, my advice, and I know I went on a bit there, my advice is whatever you've got. Like, I've ridden postie bikes, you know, up to far north New South Wales.
Yeah.
I've got mates who have ridden them across Australia through the centre. I've got, you know, I rode the Nullarbor on my postie bike. Like, whatever it is, just go on, have fun and meet some people.
That's right. And, you know, I've got a guest I had on the show last season, Jax Kennedy, who she's traveled around the world on postie bikes and even scooters and things like that. And right now she's got a postie bike with over 100,000 kilometers on it. And she's gone all over Australia. She's got her own website called Postie Notes. And, and you know, she's traveled everywhere on her postie bike. And people see her and you know, I mean, I know there's other people that have traveled on postie bikes, but when they see her, they just think, oh, geez, you've come from where on that, you know? But the thing is that any bike is really capable of doing most of the things you want to do. Obviously, you're not going to take a you know, Kawasaki ZX9 or ZX10 on a single dirt trail.
But hey, no, you better be careful what you say there. there's a guy out there. There was a guy, and this is not so many years ago. I think it was when I was doing Africa.
Yeah.
He was out there on a, and I'm going to get it wrong, but it was like a CBR 600.
Right.
Like head down, bum up, and he took that all through the world and the mud and the slop. He rode it everywhere. Yeah, I'm pretty
sure there you go.
Google him. Yeah. And I got a mate here in Australia who took a Fireblade. That's a Honda, isn't it?
CBR 900 is the Fireblade. Yeah.
Yeah. One of 900 or 1,000, whichever one whichever this one was. Mm-hmm. But a head down, you know, fairing and all that.
Yeah.
And he took it out to Northern Territory. We do an off-centre rally every 2 years to somewhere where there's a pub and there's 200 kilometres of dirt. Anyway, he took it out there and all the sand, and he's been to Mount Dare on it, and he's been, just can't think of the name of that place out in Northern Territory. We had it.
Yep.
And people couldn't even get out there on their DR650s, and he rode this road-tired, 17-inch wheeled, 1,000cc, full fairing, clip-on motorbike out there.
There you go. I'm happy to be corrected on that one for sure. Yeah. So really, the only limitation is the person sitting on the motorbike. That's the real moral of the story.
It's the person. It's the person who's riding it. Like I say, I got these other mates who have ridden postie bikes. You know.
Yeah.
Right, one side of Australia, the other. In I think the record's 5 days, 5.5 days.
Yeah.
And they mounted 30-litre safari tanks on a postie bike.
Yep.
And they just rode, like, you know, they had 900 kilometres before they'd get off and put any fuel in it. So, you know, just insanity.
Yeah.
But they do it. They do it. And, and I know them and I've ridden with them and they're legends. To me, they're just amazing people. You know?
What appeals to you most about the Royal Enfield? Is it because you rode through India with one or...?
No, the only reason, well, not the only reason, but the reason why I bought a Royal Enfield was because of Winifred Wells, who rode across Australia in 1950 as a 22-year-old girl, if you look up her story.
Yeah.
And I came across a photo of her on the internet, it sounds weird, but I fell in love with the photo.
Yeah.
And I fell in love with that person from 1950.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to emulate I think, emulate. I didn't want to copy. I just wanted to emulate her travels and have her known, because not many people before I did the ride across Australia knew who she was.
That's right.
So I bought a Royal Enfield 350. I was going to get an old one, but it all just got too hard. And so on and so forth. Anyway, I eventually got a 350, which came into Australia that year, 2016. And I bought that. And then, as they say, the rest is history. But I recreated her ride as best I could from Perth to Adelaide to Melbourne to Sydney, and then back again to Melbourne to Adelaide to Perth.
Oh, wow.
And I raised money for guide dogs, which was my goal. To raise money for someone. I just didn't want to go for a ride.
Yeah.
And my grandfather was blind, even though he never had a guide dog, but I just wanted to help some charity.
Yeah.
So I did that to recreate that for her. And then I met the Royal Enfield Club of Australia, people in there, and I really enjoy that club. And it's just grown from then, you know, the people you meet. Sort of spur you on, and you think, oh yeah, I'd like to have that bike. So I've got six Royal Enfields in the shed now after, what's that, 5 years, is it? Something like that. Yeah. So I enjoy them. I was never particularly into any specific make other than probably BMWs before that. I had lots of BMWs, but as soon as I found that photo of Winifred Wells, I just idolised her, and I actually did meet her.
Oh, really?
At the end, near the end of her life.
Oh, wow.
But I did meet her for a couple of minutes. And I find she's an inspiration. Yeah, and I just think, and that's what we get back to before, you know, getting out there and do it. She just hopped on a brand new Royal Enfield in Perth in 1950. Yeah. And rode across Australia. She didn't have fancy tyres on it or fancy handlebars or Google or...
That's right.
You know, air compressor, you know. The story still hasn't been told of all the things that she had and did. She just hopped on with some panniers and a suitcase and rode away. Pretty amazing. I got given some photos of two blokes that met her on the Nullarbor in 1950 when she was crossing. And that this bloke's grandson sent me these photos. So I framed them, you know, I copied them and whatever, or downloaded them, and I put them in a frame and I took them down to her. Yeah,
well, at least you still got to pay homage to her in some way, which I think is fantastic. So I wanted to also talk a little bit about your mechanical stuff and restorations, because at the beginning you mentioned that you're piecing together a motorcycle with a mate or for a mate. Can you talk a little bit about that as well?
Well, I've always wanted, like for many years now, or, you know, even before Royal Enfields, I always wanted to have an older bike, but a side valve. You know, everybody says the side valves are slow and whatever, but I wanted a side valve and I wanted to learn how the motor worked, because my first bike was a 250 BSA side valve, but I wasn't much into the mechanicking back then. I was more into just getting out with the mates and riding around the streets getting booked by the coppers. So, I just wanted to have a big side valve. So it came up, eventuated, that this bloke knew a bloke nearby where I live. And he had all these Royal Enfield motors and gearboxes and frames and wheels and spokes and bits and pieces. And so I met him and we did a deal and I loaded it all in my trailer and brought it home. I thought, my Lord, what have I done to myself now? So I started work on it and I got a good mate that I met through the Royal Enfield Club and my journey about Royal Enfield and that. I met him and he lives in Tassie, and he's great for advice and knowledge. And so I started putting it all together and, you know, downloading stuff about it. And I've got up to the point where I've rebuilt all the forks, I've painted the frame, I've painted the mud, I've got the mud guards on, I've got the handlebars, the forks on, wheels on, brand new tires on it. And then I started work on the motor. So it's a rolling chassis, you know, I can get it off and push it down the road. So then I started working on the motor and the big end was gone. So I got all that, pulled all that apart and the big end stuff. So you can still buy, or you can buy all the parts for lots of these things. Hitchcock's in England.
Yeah, they're great.
Has all the parts for this. So I bought a, I bit the bullet and I bought a bearing. And my wife's sitting here listening. The bearing cost me nearly $500.
What, $100? Oh, that's not bad.
So I've got a lathe. I have my own lathe and I can do simple basic lathe work, and I have a mill drill and I can do simple, like I'm a carpenter and joiner by trade, but I like my metal work and I can weld and fabricate. But doing the big end bearing and getting that set into the crank, into the connecting rod, conrod, has got a bit much for me and I just can't seem to get it right. So I've got a mate coming up later this month and he's more attuned to that. That's his occupation. He did, he was an engineer. And I said, oh, could you see if you could set this bearing up and, you know, in, on the conrod for me? Oh, yeah, no worries, Pete. We can, yeah, we should be able to sort that out. And I sent him a video of a guy in England who does them and that. He said, yeah, no worries, So hopefully within the next few months I'll get that back. And I just went to see the guys who gone and weld because a couple of lugs, like mounting lugs on the casing had broken off.
Right.
Or been broken off. So I took that to a guy to weld that up and that's been nearly a year.
Okay.
And as I said to you earlier, he promised me he's going to do it this week, so we'll see. I'll get the cases back. Then I can actually have the motor, you know, start to put the motor all back together. So I sort of visualise I won't have it finished for a year or two, but that's okay. It's not a, it's not something I need to rush through. I've got lots of other bikes to work on and customise and play with. So, yeah, so hopefully I'll get that up and rolling. And, I mean, it won't be a bike that I'm going to go travelling on, I don't think. It's just something I wanted to have a big single. Yeah, so that's what I've been doing there.
Fantastic. It sounds like a really good project. I hope that perhaps in the future I can get an update on that, even if you're just posting something on Facebook or one of the groups. But it'll be great to see the progress of that.
Yep. I've got photos of how I started it.
And, okay.
You know, but I keep I'm a bit prolific in taking photos of when I do little jobs. Like I just did a vibration reduction plate to me 535, and I fitted one to Winnie, my 350, and I fitted one to that 500 Classic, and I just put one on the 535, and I put a 19 tooth sprocket on it, and that sort of thing. So, yeah, I take photos. You know, some days I forget because I get so preoccupied with what I'm doing, I forget to take time out to take a photo. I have photos of that, and like I rebuilt a postie 1968 postie, or like a CT90.
That would have been a CT90.
With the little leading links, little tele links at the front, on the front end, with the shock absorbers in them. Anyway, I rebuilt that from scratch.
Oh, very nice.
During COVID for this guy, it turned out immaculate. He's happy as a pig in poo. But, so I took lots of photos of that. But I take photos. I like taking photos. I'm not a great cameraman, but I take photos just with my phone. And I enjoy downloading them and sending them off. You know, like I've got mates that are always interested, and I send them off and I post them up on the Royal Enfield site, club site, and on Facebook, obviously, that you've seen.
Yeah,
I enjoy that. You know, I've got no secrets. I just enjoy, you know, the dumb things I do and the good things I do. You know, dumb stuff, and I've posted up that too. But yeah, no, I enjoy that. I like people. It's something I miss in the club, because the club at the moment the Royal Enfield Club, they've sort of, I don't know whether it's COVID, I've actually asked, I put up a post on the club site, which is only for club members, you know, is everybody all right, you know, just checking, because, you know, about mental health, but also about, you know, why aren't you posting anything, you know, it's been really quiet, are you okay, you know, is everybody checking on everybody? And I actually got at least a dozen returns. Yeah, yeah, it's all okay, Beetle. Yeah, yeah, we're just doing other things and whatever. And, oh, okay, righto. You know, so some people's heads are spinning. And one guy was, yeah, he was pleased someone asked because he was having a few issues. So, but I like posting stuff up and telling people because I don't only post stuff and I don't only talk about things that I don't know. I also talk about things that I think other people would like to know. You know, I already know the answer, but I'm asking the question so that other people feel, oh, he asked a really dumb question, do you? It's not so bad answer, you know, which I don't think there is a dumb question.
No, absolutely.
What I'm trying to get at is that it sort of might impetus people to say, oh, well, I could ask that question, you know, and I won't get laughed at. Because I think a lot of people are quite cruel when you ask questions. Oh, you dumb bugger, you know, why didn't you bloody know that?
That's right. No. I mean, I'm an ex-bike mechanic, but even I just bought myself a Himalayan, or Himalayan, sorry. And and it's the first bike I've had with, you know, EFI and ABS and all that. And the ABS light came on a few days ago, and I kind of, you know, I had no idea what to do because it's all computers and it's all that stuff. And I asked on the Royal Enfield Himalayan Australian group, and I got a whole bunch of different answers, which all helped because I just went through and troubleshooted that. But for me, because I'm an old carbies and points guy, you know, that's how I grew up playing with bikes. And when I was in the bike industry, carburetors and electronic ignition was a thing. But when I left the industry, EFI just came in, so I missed out on all that.
Right.
And to be honest, that may be a blessing in disguise. I'm okay playing with carbies and points. Electronic fuel injection, I just don't understand. So, you know, I just asked the dumb question of, you know, my ABS light's coming on the bike right now. Does anyone know what that means? Because normally there's codes or flashing or something like that. But one guy said that he found one of the sensors on the wheels was dirty. Just have a look at it. And sure enough, I pulled it off. It was covered in dirt, but what the main problem was I must have gone through some dirt that had a lot of iron in it or something. There were some iron filings on the magnet, which obviously caused the magnetic field to not work. Anyway, long story short, I fixed it by just cleaning the iron filings off the sensor and putting it back on, and it worked fine. So, you know, it was a dumb question, and someone like me who's a mechanic who technically, you know, I should know, the reality is just that, yeah, sometimes you can just ask those dumb questions and you get the answer, and yeah, I don't think there's any shame in that at all, and I don't think there's any dumb questions, so yeah,
no,
absolutely.
No, exactly, absolutely. And I mean, well, I've just, yeah, you've reiterated what I try to tell people. You know, they always jump, well, not always, but they jump to conclusions and they try to find the hardest thing. I said, well, how about going back to basics and starting, you know, at the bottom.
That's right.
And see if you can fix it, you know. Yeah. Like, goodness me, what are you reaching for the sky for straight away? It might be, just a bit of dirt on a contact. What
That's
are you
it.
Talking about? You
That's
know?
It. Well, the first thing I did was check the fuses because that was always my thing. And when I was an apprentice, I remember one of the other apprentices chasing his tail trying to find an electrical fault. And the head mechanic came over and said, did you check the fuses? And he pulled the fuse out and, of course, it was blown. You know,
that's... Right. Yeah. First thing. That's
first
it.
First thing. That's it.
Good one.
So you spoke about seeing a pub before in Alaska. What would you say in your travels around the world was one of the best pubs or water holes that you've been to where, you know, you can recommend to any of us, whether it be here in Australia or overseas?
Oh, no, I'd have to pick an Australian one.
Good man.
the best drinking water hole. I would have said, Where would I say would be the nicest place I've had a drink? I'm just so many pubs I go to. You won't believe how many pubs I go to. Bloody pubs a lot.
Yeah. Oh. Well, if it makes it easier, can you give us a top five?
Top five. Wait, my wife's looking at me, going to say something.
The one going across that you always say you want to go and live there.
Oh, right. Yeah. The Kingunya Hotel. Yeah, that's a cool. Good one, lovey. So that brings me, if you know where Kingunya is in South Australia, that's always a good time there.
Yeah.
Because I'm regularly, more times than I can count on one hand, I've been across the Transcontinental Railway line, like the service road. I've ridden across there.
Yep.
I even took the Royal Enfield halfway across one year after I come down the Great Central Road on an outback trip. And, Kingunya Pub, okay. Just out from Glendambo, up there in South Australia. That's a great pub. But honestly, to me, I reckon just about, and I know this is so vague and it's not helping you, but just about any pub in a country, small country town, you know, like there's a pub, Fifield up in central New South Wales. You're making me memory tick now. that pub is just, I know they're trying to sell it, but that pub is just amazing. Every time I've been there, no matter who owned it, you can get a meal from 8 o'clock in the morning or 8:30 in the morning. You can get breakfast and you can get a meal, whatever you want, until 8:30 at night.
Wow. That's pretty good. Oh, you're there? Oh, have I lost you?
10 till 10. So, you know, the place is open all the time. It's just an amazing place to go there. And it's just the town wouldn't have 30 people in it, I don't reckon, Fifield.
Yeah.
What a great pub there. It's two-story and the owners are getting a bit on now and they want to retire.
Yeah.
Last time I was there last year. But just a great place because so many pubs now, sadly, they don't open till 2 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the afternoon in the country. Like, it's just... You know, I know our local pub. I love our local pub, but midday, 2 o'clock is when they open. And I thought, well, you know, crazy me, I like to have a beer at 11. I like that. It's a bloody good idea.
Absolutely.
Oh,
nice one. And of course, because we're called Bikes, Burgers, Beers, what would you say is one of your favourite beers?
One of my favourite beers is Guinness.
Yeah, oh,
that's
nice.
That's my favourite, but I can virtually never ever find it. It's very hard to find it in the country or here. We had a pub here in town, an Irish-type pub that used to do Guinness. But other than that, I'm trying to be a good little boy lately and I'm drinking, I call it a Brito, but it's... I think it's a light beer. I call it a Brito because the guy in town, one of the legends in my little town here at Tangambalanga, he drinks it all the time. And to be honest with you, I can't even remember because I called it a Brito. I don't know, it's just a blue can, a light beer. Yeah,
okay.
A light beer.
Oh, nice.
I've been drinking that. But honestly, any beer is my favourite. Anybody who wants to buy me one when they meet me somewhere, I'll be happy to drink it with you. Well, I'll drink VB, I'll drink anything.
Yeah, nice one.
Guinness I do enjoy. Yes, I do enjoy a Guinness.
Yeah, likewise, I like my dark beers, so Guinness is definitely up there. When I see an Irish pub, it's always a wise decision to head in and get a Guinness.
Oh, positively. As long as you got nothing else special to do with the day.
That's it.
It's 2 points for Guinness and I'm bloody anybody's.
Oh, beautiful. And so out of all these pubs, we spoke about the pub before being open, the kitchen being open from 8 o'clock in the morning till 8 o'clock at night. Do you like hamburgers? Have you eaten burgers around these pubs?
Yes, and I'm going to tell you, the Union Burger at the Union Hotel in Tangambalanga is the best burger.
Absolutely, yeah. What makes it so good?
Oh, it's just got everything on it, and it is huge. You can't even get the toppings and everything. You just can't even. Can't barely get your hands over it. And I'm talking serious, not Hungry Jack type stuff. I'm talking a real serious burger.
Yeah,
big burger itself. You know, like the bun or the bread or whatever.
Yeah,
and just so much filling and the meat. Yeah, it's just fantastic. Yeah, buddy, the Union Burger. That's the one. Yeah.
Okay, I'll definitely have to look them up because I'll put all this information in the show notes for my listeners, because if they're ever around that area, probably good for them to come in and definitely have a nice feed by the sounds of it.
Oh, positively. Yeah. I mean, sadly, they don't, like lots of pubs now, they don't serve every day of the week, but I think meals are open from Wednesday to Sunday night. And, you know, with this COVID stuff, they're having issues with staff and that.
Yeah.
But generally speaking, they're open and, you know, have a meal, full meal. They even do pizzas there. But if you just punch in Union Hotel at Tangambalanga, it comes up and, they've got their Facebook page and that. Really good. Oh,
beautiful, mate. Well, before we finish up, I usually just ask all my guests on the show, is there anything you'd like to add that we haven't covered or something that you'd like to share with my listeners before we say goodbye?
Well, the only thing I'd like to share, motorcycling and travelling in that, is let's just be nice to each other and try to wave. I mean, be friendly. Like when I travelled in America, everybody waved, from a Harley rider to a little step through. But here in Australia, I don't know what's wrong with us. We seem to have this, prejudice or angriness towards other makes. It just drives me nuts. I've owned and ridden Harleys, BMWs, Japanese bikes, you know. No, just wave and say hello and just be friendly. That's my message to everybody.
Definitely great advice, mate. Much appreciated. Well, thank you so much for spending the time to come onto the show. I really do appreciate it, and I hope my listeners do as well. I'm sure they will, and I think they'll enjoy listening to all your stories of travelling all over the world on your motorcycles. So, yeah, thank you again, mate.
No worries. Thank you.
Well, ladies and gents, that was Brian Bailey. What a guy. You know what? When I asked him to be on the show, he said to me, look, I probably don't have much to tell you. I'll let you listeners be the judge of that, because it sounds like we only skimmed the tip of the iceberg, and I look forward to getting Brian back on the show in a few seasons to see what's new. I'm sure he'll have 100 other adventures to talk about. You know, and I think Australia is full of guys like Brian, local legends who, if anything, are little known. I know that if you follow us here at Bikes, Burgers, Beers, especially on our YouTube channel, you will have seen that I was on Biker Talk with Ross quite a few months ago. Well, since following Ross's channel, I've noticed that he discovers and shares stories very similar to Brian's by many other gentlemen across Australia and New South Wales. So head over to Ross's channel and make sure you hit subscribe on Biker Talk. That wraps things up for this episode of Bikes, Burgers, Beers. Please hit that subscribe button so you get updates for new episodes, and now you can support us on Ko-fi.com, where you can make us a one-off donation for the show. Go on, buy me a coffee, buy me a beer. The funds go towards our additional support for gear and, equally as important, the Big Steph Beer Fund. So, gear and beer, what could go wrong? I also want to remind everyone that the Content Creators Meetup in East Lynn at the Fuel Cafe is still happening on the 27th of August 2022. I'll be there along with Rob from Throttle Down Under and many other people, some of which have been guests on the show here. So see you there. And on that final word, thanks for listening to Bikes, Burgers, Beers. I've been Big Steph. You've been awesome. And remember, folks, keep it twisted.